Hello, everyone. Welcome to a discussion about the law of alcohol distribution in the United States, which is an introduction to the three-tier system. My name is Jeffrey O'Brien. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Chestnut Cambrone in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I have been working with beverage clients, liquor clients, for a number of years with a focus on the burgeoning craft beverage industry as in the last 10 years. I have about 50 to 60 craft breweries, craft distilleries, a few wineries focusing on cider mainly, and mainly those in Minnesota. So some of my comments today will be talking a lot about some specific Minnesota law, but some of these things, when we get into distribution laws, you'll see some similarities across the various states. There may be a different word used here or there, but the concepts are the same. So, I think it's going to be an interesting topic. I mean, this is probably when people talk about, brewery law, a lot of brewery law is nothing different than corporate law or intellectual property, securities, real estate. This area here is really the meat of brewery law, liquor law in general, is these distribution relationships, and they're very important. So with that, we're going to get into it here. And we're going to talk about, start with an overview of the topics that we're going to cover. I'm going to start with giving kind of a history and overview of what we call the three-tier system. And what I mean by the three-tier system is the three tiers of liquor production and sales, that is manufacturing, distribution, and retail sales. And we'll talk about the history of that, how that came to be, why this stuff comes out of prohibition, and then some people are particularly going to be talking about the relationship between two of the tiers, meaning the manufacturers and the distributors. We'll talk about state distribution laws. For many states, there are laws governing the relationship between breweries and distributors. Other states, there may be some relationships between distillers and wineries and distributors, but by and large, the statutory schemes for breweries, and again, we'll talk about the history, there's a history behind that as well. We'll talk about some recent exceptions that have been carved out across the country to this three-tier system. We'll talk about sales of distribution rights. This is a relatively new concept where breweries are selling their distribution rights to distributors, and talk about the idea behind that and the implications for that. We'll talk about a very recent development, which is small brewer exemptions to state distribution laws. And then if we have a little bit of time at the end, we'll touch briefly on a comparison between distribution issues in the wine and spirits industries. But the bulk of what we're going to talk about relates to breweries. So we're going to talk about a history and overview of the three-tier system. Now, the three-tier system really arises out of prohibition. The 18th Amendment and the Volstead Act that prohibited the manufacture and sale of liquor in the United States. And one of the biggest issues, if you recall back to the temperance movement and the push for prohibition in this country, one of the big issues that was the reason for prohibition becoming the law of the land was this concept of tied houses. Now, tied houses, tied house means a tavern or bar that has an exclusive relationship with a brewery, meaning that bar or that tavern is only going to sell that brewery's products. The tied house system has its origins in Britain, when British commercial brewers began to dominate the production sale of beer. They started to vie with each other for trade in specific areas, so they all started their own taverns, and then that was really kind of expand their market and their appeal. And that, of course, given how much of U.S. history starts with carrying over from traditions from British history, British traditions, that's where this came from. You heard stories about, you know, breweries actually owning taverns here in the U.S. and, you know, giving the workers free, you know, salty snacks or salty sandwiches around the lunchtime to get them to buy beers to quench their thirst. So that's where this idea of the Tide House comes, and that was a big reason why we ended up with prohibition of liquor manufacture and sales in the U.S. Tide houses today are really a relic of the past. The concept survives a little bit in this niche, the notion of a brew pub, where you have basically a restaurant that's making its own beer, but it's really not the same animal. The Tide House specifically refers to a tavern that was under control of a brewery. So so much of our liquor law in this country originates out of prohibition, the temperance movement, and then the repeal of prohibition under the 21st Amendment. So prohibition of the 18th Amendment and the Volstead Act. The 18th Amendment established the prohibition of alcoholic beverages in the United States by declaring the production, transport, and sale of alcohol illegal. The Volstead Act, I'm sitting here in Minnesota, and actually the Volstead Act is named for a congressman by the name of Andrew Volstead, who actually hails from Minnesota. So you have us to thank for that. I apologize for that. So they listed, you know, the Volstead Act listed which liquors were intoxicating liquors and which were prohibited and which were excluded, you know, some for medical and religious purposes. So we had the 18th Amendment. Of course, we end up with the bootlegger movement and a lot of the organized crime. There's so much bad stuff that happens with prohibition that, you know, nobody ever stops necessarily making it. They just do it illicitly. But it did end up bringing about the end to a number of small breweries around the country. What we're seeing now with all of these breweries around the country, that's how it used to be. Everybody had their local brewery. And a number of them decided after prohibition was enacted that it just wasn't economical for them to continue on making soda pop, so, or something else, non-alcoholic, and so they shut their doors. Some of them survived doing that and came back, but we lost a lot of breweries when prohibition was enacted. So the prohibition comes about in 1919. In 1933 is when the 21st Amendment is passed and ratified, which repeals prohibition. Now, this is the key to our discussion here. Just like today, where we don't have we have compromises on various pieces of legislation, for as bad as things were in the U.S. under prohibition in the 18th Amendment, there were not enough votes in the United States Senate for a clean repeal of the 18th Amendment and the Volstead Act. So there was a compromise reached. And the compromise was that they would repeal the Volstead Act and the 18th Amendment, but each state would be given the authority to regulate the production, importation, distribution, sale, and consumption of alcoholic beverages within their own borders. And this is what gives rise to what we now refer to as the three-tier system. And the reason for this, the theory behind the three-tier system, directly relates back to that, to the concerns over the Tide houses. There was a concern over letting manufacturers of alcohol who, everybody, you know, even though it was, you know, prohibition was a failure and they repealed it, there still was this bias against the makers of alcohol. And so it was decided that the manufacturers of liquor were somehow bad and they needed to be regulated and they shouldn't be able to sell directly to retailers. And that's where we come up with this three-tier system and the middleman, which is the distributors, also known as wholesalers. So that's how this whole system comes about. And so this has been the system that has been in place since the repeal of Prohibition in 1933. Now, fast forward a few decades, and this is where we get these state distribution laws enacted in earnest. In the 60s and even the early 70s, we saw a lot of consolidation in the brewing industry. A lot of small breweries were bought up or acquired by larger breweries. You saw, breweries like Anheuser-Busch bought up a lot of small breweries. G. Heilemann, Miller, Coors, all these various breweries acquired the small breweries, and they went away. And so you have large breweries and then the distributors, which are usually kind of small local guys. At least historically, that's what it had been. And there was a concern that, and there was some evidence to support it, that these bigger breweries were maybe taking advantage of the small distributors, forcing them to carry certain brands if they wanted certain other popular brands, or being able to force them to down to on their pricing and making it so that it was hard for a distributor to make a profit trying to carry these brands. So a number of states, almost all states, enacted some form of distribution law that regulated the relationship between the brewer and the wholesaler. And when I say the brewer, I mean that. We'll talk later about what the rules are for wineries and distilleries. They're a little bit different. But the state distribution laws, generally speaking, affect the brewer wholesaler relationship. The relationship is primarily governed by a contract that we call a distribution agreement. And the heart of the distribution agreement is the termination, the inability of the brewer to terminate its relationship, or terminate the contract, and go to another distributor. And we refer to these distribution laws sometimes as franchise laws, because if any of you that are listening to this are familiar with franchise laws and the ability of a franchisor to terminate its franchisee, there are similar termination restrictions under beer distribution laws in each state, meaning it's very difficult for a brewer to terminate its contract with a wholesaler unless there's cause to do so. And we'll talk about that here in a minute. Some states' distribution laws are more favorable to distributors than others. I'm sitting in a state, Minnesota, where I would say we have one of the most favorable distribution laws to distributors that there is in the country. The big issues with distribution agreements are what creates a distribution arrangement, what creates the agreement, what the termination restrictions are, what constitutes good cause that would give rise to termination, what notice is required, and what reasonable compensation must be paid to a wholesaler for a brewery to terminate its relationship. So for this discussion, I'm going to use the Minnesota Beer Brewers and Wholesalers Act, which is Minnesota Statutes Chapter 325B. Most states are similar to what Minnesota does. Minnesota has a few things, and I'll point those out, that are a little bit unique. There will be an appendix in the written materials here where it goes through a summary of each state's distribution laws, so you can see a nice kind of a layout of all the states that have distribution laws and generally what they say. But you'll see when you look at that, that by and large, state by state, the concepts are the same. So the Minnesota Act, it was passed in 1977, so right at the end of this period of consolidation amongst the big brewers. Again, the purpose, of course, is to, the legislative purpose was to protect local wholesalers. Because, of course, it's, you know, that's this is the cynical side of me. The reason that they were trying to protect local wholesalers is because local wholesalers have the ability to write them campaign checks, whereas the big brewers were, you know, they weren't here. So, you know, the act has been challenged over the years. Courts have consistently upheld it and found that it has legitimate purposes of prohibiting brewers from fixing wholesale prices, coercing wholesalers to accept delivery of unordered products, or discriminating among wholesalers. And that's one of the hallmarks of this is every wholesaler has to be treated equally. A brewer can't give a brewer can't favor one wholesaler over another. A brewery can't dictate what prices the wholesalers can sell for, which, of course, the wholesalers like. Because, I mean, but right now under this three-tier system, the wholesalers probably make more money than either of the two tiers, the manufacturers or the retailers. I would say, generally speaking, there's about a 30% markup from what the prices that the wholesaler buys the beer at to what they sell it to the retailer at. So, you know, they do well. And, you know, I've sat through presentations where lawyers for the wholesalers say, we like the current system because we make a lot of money. I'm like, well, points for honesty. So the Minnesota Act is a little bit unique in terms of its creation provision. Most states say in order to create a distribution agreement, with a wholesaler, it has to be in writing. Now, what that means can mean a lot of things. You know, in this day and age with email communication, that certainly could form the basis for creating a distribution agreement under Minnesota law. But under Minnesota law, you don't even have to have that. I advise clients when I first meet with them, and it's weird because I'm meeting with them talking about we aren't even open yet. We're talking about just getting started, forming an entity, finding property, doing the lease, raising money, the regulatory, you know, the license applications, and I'm talking about distribution. But I tell them, you don't ever give even a drop of your product to a wholesaler without having a written contract. Because under Minnesota law, you can create a distribution agreement without having a written contract. Now, that's different from a lot of other states. This is a little bit unique to Minnesota, but it bears pointing out. So I've had a few over the years clients that, before I was able to give this speech, maybe gave a keg or something to a wholesaler, let them take it to a liquor store, a bar, and test it, and they found themselves with their distributor. So it's one of those issues you have to be careful with. Like I said, I won't even let clients sign letters of intent or memorandums of understanding or anything. If they want to exchange a wholesaler wants to email a proposal, I don't even let my client say, that looks good, send over a contract. Send over a contract and we'll review it. So you have to be careful there. Other states are a little more friendly. You do have to have a written agreement, but it's generally speaking a good idea to get in there and work with, you know, be able to take the agreement and revise it. I joke that I'm proud of the fact that when I get a distribution agreement from a wholesaler, that my goal is to put, when I redline it, my goal is to have more red ink on the page, in the document at the end of the day than there is black ink. And sometimes, believe it or not, it does happen that way. So, creation of the agreement is an important aspect. The other big issue is, of course, the termination restrictions. I alluded to this earlier that they call these franchise laws because of the franchise type termination restrictions. So I'll give you an example. This is the Minnesota provision about termination. It says, notwithstanding the terms, provisions, or conditions of any agreement, no brewer shall amend, cancel, terminate, or refuse to continue to renew any agreement, or cause a wholesaler to resign from an agreement, unless the brewer has satisfied the notice and opportunity to cure requirements of Minnesota Statute Section 325B.05, has acted in good faith, and has good cause for the cancellation, termination, non-renewal, discontinuance, or forced resignation. Now, go back and parse that a little bit. That's pretty powerful in terms of a restriction. It's not just about an amendment. It's not just terminating the agreement. Refuse to continue to renew. So non-renewal triggers the for-cause requirement, or forcing the wholesaler to resign. So you see that no termination unless they have good cause. Okay? This is significant in light of, and this is why we want to have a very well drafted, attorney drafted, and negotiated written agreement, because we'll talk about in a minute here about what constitutes good cause, but those issues of what triggers the right to terminate is a big issue. Now, it doesn't mean that necessarily that you're going to be successful in terminating, but what I tell clients, what I tell lawyers is it at least takes away one fact issue from the court when this ultimately ends up in litigation, that the argument of whether or not there was good cause to terminate. If you have a well-drafted and agreement with several paragraphs enumerating what constitutes cause, and I'll give you a minute, this is additional artful language you have to add to it, at least makes your case a little bit better. So what does constitute good cause? Now, again, I'm reading out on the Minnesota law, but like I said, if you look at any of the statutes cited in Appendix 1, you're going to see the same language across any state's distribution agreement, maybe one word variation here and there. So the Minnesota statute says good cause includes, but is not limited to, the following. Revocation of the wholesaler's license. That makes sense. I mean, if they don't have a license to be a wholesaler anymore, it seems reasonable that you shouldn't be stuck with them as your wholesaler. The wholesaler's bankruptcy or insolvency. Again, if they're bankrupt, they're insolvent, seems a good reason to terminate. Assignment of the assets of the wholesaler for the benefit of creditors, or a similar disposition of the wholesaler's assets. Again, a no-brainer. The fourth reason, this is the money clause. A failure by the wholesaler to substantially comply without reasonable excuse or justification with any reasonable and material requirement imposed on the wholesaler by the brewer, where the failure is discovered by the brewer not more than 1 year before the date on which the brewer gave notice to the wholesaler. You'll notice that good cause does not include the sale or purchase of a brewer. In fact, our statute here in Minnesota explicitly says that the brands that the wholesaler carries or has the rights to are able to be sold by that wholesaler to another wholesaler. And we'll talk about that, the implications for that for breweries a little bit later. Minnesota's language says it's a reasonable and material requirement imposed on the wholesaler by the brewer. Each state has some variation on that language, but it's essentially the same thing. And this is where, as when we draft drafting these agreements, this is why this is important, to have an attorney draft a negotiated agreement. There are no, if you notice there is nothing in those cause, you know, those good cause enumerations about a lack of marketing of a brewery's product or insufficient quality control in terms of storage and warehousing of the brewery's products. If you want to have, if your client wants those types of provisions to trigger a good cause termination, the contract has to state that. And not only does it have to state that those are good cause, because the statute basically, if you, most statutes override the contract. They say, notwithstanding any provision in the contract, this is what constitutes good cause. Okay? So in order to get those types of things to be considered good cause, you have to say, what I include at the end of my enumerated, what I do is I include a section on the wholesaler obligations and, you know, list them all. And then at the very end, I have an acknowledgement that the both parties acknowledge that a breach of any of these provisions by the wholesaler, that these provisions constitute the reasonable and material requirements imposed on the wholesaler by the brewer, and that a breach of any of these obligations would constitute good cause under, and then I cite the statute, depending on whatever state we're dealing with. So that's how you do it, is how you shoehorn in quality control and marketing obligations into the good cause definition to be able to terminate the agreement would be to list them all, have an acknowledgement by both parties that these are reasonable material requirements or whatever the magic language is under that state's law, and then further acknowledge that a breach of any of those constitutes good cause. Now, I can tell you, when I'm dealing with a lawyer for a wholesaler, I would say I'm about 90% successful in getting whatever I want in those provisions constituting good cause. Usually, the only one they usually push back on, I try to stick in there that the wholesaler has to sit down with the brewer every year and create a marketing plan. And they generally don't want to give us the right to terminate for failure to agree upon a marketing plan. So, but other than that, you know, I've been able to have success getting these additional provisions into the agreement and under the good cause requirement. So, there are, except there's very few cases on a lot of these state laws, or the state distribution laws. Most of them involve big brewers, so they usually fall in favor of the wholesaler. We'll see. Now, we'll talk in a little bit about one case recently where the brewers beat the wholesalers down in Texas. So this is, some of this stuff, there's not a lot of case law fleshing this stuff out. So we'll see now that we have all these small breweries in this country, how this changes over time, now that we're essentially operating under two systems, big brewer versus small wholesaler, and then, of course, a number of the wholesalers have consolidated, so now you have big wholesalers and smaller brewers. Okay, so back to the distribution laws. So we've gone through the creation and the termination section here on good cause. That's one threshold. You have good cause. The next piece is that you have to give notice. I'm going to read again the Minnesota provision. Notwithstanding any provision to the contrary in any agreement. So there we go. We're overriding the contract again between a brewer and a wholesaler. A brewer who intends to terminate, cancel, discontinue, or refuse to renew an agreement with a wholesaler must furnish written notice to that effect to the wholesaler not less than 90 days before the effective date of the intended action, and must provide the wholesaler with a bona fide opportunity to substantially cure any claim deficiency within the 90 days. So, that's pretty uniform across the board, across the various state distribution laws. I've seen, I think there's a few of them that might have a 60-day, but for the most part, it's a 90-day written notice requirement, an opportunity to cure. Then you get into how it has to be sent by, you know, certified mail and effective dates and you know, continued, you know, the statement of the action. You have to give this prescribed notice once and list what the good cause is as to the reason why you believe you have grounds to terminate. Okay. Now we get into reasonable compensation. We're not done yet here. Our statute says any brewer which terminates or refuses to continue or renew any brewer agreement unless for good cause shown shall pay the wholesaler a reasonable compensation for the value of the wholesaler's business with relationship to the terminated brand or brands. The value of the wholesaler's business shall include but not be limited to its goodwill, if any. So if this ends up cannot end up, of course, in litigation, our state statute provides for arbitration with both parties splitting the cost of it. If the brewer and the wholesaler can't determine reasonable compensation, spoiler alert, if a brewer is terminating for a cause, a brewer and a wholesaler are likely not going to be able to agree on compensation. So it's going to end up in arbitration. As you can see, a complicated statute that if a brewery were to exercise its termination rights, the odds are extremely high that it's going to end up in court. And that's the way the wholesalers want it, because the wholesalers are better funded than the breweries. This statute acts as a deterrent to terminate your relationship with your distributor. And thus, I very often refer to these when someone signs up a distribution agreement, they got married. This is a lifetime arrangement. So, as a practical tip to your clients, they have to be extremely careful who they're signing on with, is this a good fit for them? Because if not, they're kind of stuck. So that's the kind of the statutory scheme generally on distribution laws and distribution agreements. Now, in recent years, breweries around the country, so this is really kind of arising out of the wave of craft breweries that have come about in the U.S. Over the past decade and a half or so. There have been a number of different rights afforded to smaller brewers that really act as exceptions to the three-tier system. And we'll talk about a few. There's three generally, and we'll talk about each one of them in turn. One of them is self-distribution rights, which is the brewery's right to distribute its own product. The other is the direct sales on-premise for off-sale consumption, primarily in the form of growlers. Some states allow various different things. Minnesota allows growlers and 750-milliliter containers. Other states actually do allow six-packs or other types of bottle sizes. So that varies from state to state in terms of what else they are allowed to sell. In my second appendix to the materials, I go through a summary of the various self-distribution laws in the various states. You take a look at those and see how they compare. The third, and probably one of the most important, at least in Minnesota, the most important exception that's come about is the allowing a production brewery to have what's called a tap room. And I'll talk about that shortly. So we've got self-distribution rights, growlers, and tap rooms that have all come to become extremely important to the craft beer industry, and these are all exceptions to this general rule that breweries aren't allowed to sell directly to not just to retailers, but to customers directly. And all of these, when you're dealing with self-distribution rights, you're talking about a brewery selling directly to a retailer. With growlers and a tap room, you're actually allowing them to sell directly to the general public. So these laws are hard fought. They change a little bit, usually every 2 years, every legislative session, because we're playing with fire here. This is this is the heart of why we had prohibition, these tied houses. And plus you have very entrenched special interests in the form of the wholesalers and the retailers that do quite well and don't necessarily want to see their share of the market carved out so that the breweries can make more money on their end. So we'll talk about self-distribution rights. So most states, many states, permit a brewery, breweries that are below a certain production threshold to distribute their product directly to retailers without the use of a distributor. The advantage for the brewery that's self-distributing, it gives them, you know, they're going to be the most knowledgeable about their product because they produced it. They can go out and, you know, that door-to-door relationship selling, go to the various liquor stores, various bars, and introduce themselves, introduce their products, maybe put on a sampling, and get their customers, get retailers to like their products and want them to come back. And I will. So, the flip side of that is distribution isn't cheap. You know, if you're successful in growing your brand, it requires you to have a sales staff and trucks, and you know those trucks break down and there's maintenance, and and you're also up against your competition is not only other breweries but the wholesalers. And the wholesalers, you know, their job is to build relationships and sell product. So you're kind of David fighting Goliath in terms of trying to get your product on a tap, you know, to have a bar replace some tap lines with product with beers of yours versus something that they were offered by the distributor they have a relationship with. But anyway, so for example, in Minnesota, our threshold for self distribution is 20,000 barrels. Now, a barrel is 31 gallons, is roughly a barrel. So, not a very high limit here. It used to be 25,000. There was a compromise reached when the breweries were allowed to sell growlers on Sundays, and they had to give up. They had to drop the self-distribution limit down to 20,000 barrels. Now, by contrast, I believe Wisconsin is 300,000 barrels. And I joke with people, the reason for the difference between Minnesota at 20,000 barrels and Wisconsin at 300,000 barrels is, well, in Minnesota, the wholesalers pay for the laws to be written. they have to call the capital. And in Wisconsin, they have Miller. And so you're going to see, you have a brewery in the state, so you're going to get laws that are more favorable to a big brewery versus here, where the whole goal is to try to, they're always trying to play block and tackle and keeping the big breweries from coming in and, taking over the system. So that's where our limit is much lower at 20,000 barrels. The second exception to the three-tier system that's come about is the sales on-premises at the brewery of containers for off-premises consumption, primarily growlers. Growlers are those big glass jugs, the 64-ounce jugs that you can fill up right there from the tap. They put a seal around it, and you take it home, and you drink it. Maybe you have a matter of days to drink it before it starts to go bad, but that's the freshest beer you can get right there out of the tap. So if someone's visiting the tap room and they, maybe have a pint or flight or two and they want to take some home, they can always, fill up a growler for the road, take it home and consume it there. In Minnesota, we also allow for 750 milliliter bottles sold for off-premise consumption, so like a, champagne bottle, special releases, barrel-aged beers, those types of limited edition type releases. You're likely to see those sold out of the brewery. You also see these, what they call them, crowlers, which is a oversized beer can, but instead of going with a growler, it's just basically that you can fill that. I kind of like the growlers better practically as a consumer. Trying to, the hallmark of craft beer is to sample a lot of different products, and having to come to consume 64 ounces of one beer versus being able to buy two or three growlers of different beers. I like that about that. So those have been a nice little thing here. So under Minnesota law, what the way the statutory scheme works is that the state law permits a municipality to create a license for a local brewery to sell growlers. So they leave it in the hands of the city or county to decide if they're going to have a growler license. Why do they do that? Well, here Minnesota has this scheme of municipal liquor stores where city governments actually own and run the liquor stores in town, and they tend to limit the number of other licenses that go out to a liquor license and what else. So they did this so that they allow the cities with municipal liquor stores to limit the number that, usually they'll say, well, only two of these growler licenses can be issued at one time. There's usually limits as to how much beer can be sold off sale like that in growlers or other containers. In recent years here, we've now allowed for the Sunday sale of these growlers. This was a huge fight. Minnesota just earlier this year enacted a law that would repeal the ban on Sunday liquor sales. Up until July 1st of this year here in Minnesota, you could not go into a liquor store on a Sunday and buy product. You could only go to a bar. And so now you can do that. But this, before they went full Sunday sales, they first allowed the breweries to sell off sale on Sundays. So, the third big exception has been tap rooms, and this has been huge here in Minnesota. Minnesota now, I think we're getting close to 200 breweries, being open. More licenses have been granted. And some of them are still in process. But, before the tap room law here in Minnesota was passed in 2011. What a tap room is simply a space adjacent to the production brewery where people can come and purchase pints of beer, can purchase flights, they can sit there just like in a bar setting and consume the product on premise. At least under our statute, you're also allowed to have a restaurant there. So really, that's the difference between a brew pub and a brewery these days. It's not that a brew pub can serve food, it's that a brew pub, we go back to that Tide House concept. A brew pub, if a brew pub opens up five locations, they can distribute their beer amongst all five of their locations, whether it be a brewery, like a brew pub, a group that has maybe a brew pub and three restaurants, they can distribute their beer to those three restaurants, but they're capped at a certain amount of beer they can do, but they can't distribute to liquor stores or other retail license holders. So there's the limits on distribution for that right to be able to distribute around your various locations. But for a brewery, a tap room has been huge. The margins on a tap room are about 80%. So a brewery does very well selling beer out of its tap room versus them into the distribution system and where the wholesalers make more of the money and the retailers make more of the money than what the brewery does. So I think, like I said, I think we had about a dozen breweries open prior to 2011 here in Minnesota before there was a taproom law. Now that the taproom law, it's approaching 200. So it's been a huge game changer here in Minnesota. And other states have found this as well, that these taprooms are a great way for breweries to make a nice little profit. And that's the way that the nature of craft beer. They aren't just like for a standard anymore, you would go to a liquor store and buy. You want to go there and try their seasonals or a special infusion release for that week or day. So the taprooms have been really kind of nice laboratories for a lot of different styles. So those are the sales and distribution rights. As I mentioned before, most state distribution statutes will provide that if a wholesaler sells its assets to another wholesaler, and this has been happening quite a bit around the country. A lot of wholesalers have been consolidating, just like we had the breweries consolidating in the 60s and 70s, now we have wholesalers consolidating. And so the wholesalers, if they sell out to another wholesaler, the brewery, subject to some very narrow exceptions, is essentially dragged along in the deal. There's no provision where you can simply terminate your agreement because your wholesaler sells out to somebody else. And so someone got the idea that, well, hey, if a wholesaler can sell this bundle of rights that we call distribution rights to another wholesaler, why can't we as a brewery who has the right to self-distribute sell those rights to a wholesaler? And coupled with that, there's usually prohibitions under state laws that forbid a wholesaler from purchasing equipment for a brewery. So you've got that thinking of if they can sell them, we can sell them, plus that restriction. And what's happened has been, in very recent years, that breweries are selling their distribution rights, their exclusive distribution rights, to a wholesaler, and then they take the funds that the wholesaler has paid them, and they use it for expansion purposes, acquiring new equipment, and growing the production of the brewery. Because their focus then can be more on making beer and less about having to sell it, because now that you've got a distributor that has your exclusive rights, and it's their job to go out and sell it. So it seemed like a clever idea. And you know when it's a clever idea when one of the other tiers, or at least both the other tiers, don't like it. And we saw this play out down in Texas. There was a law passed in 2013 at the behest of the wholesalers in Texas that would that prohibited the sale of distribution rights. This was challenged, and in 2016, Texas court struck down that law as unconstitutional. So that's the only test that they've had thus far, and the court in Texas said, no, it's permitted. So a brewery can sell its distribution rights to a wholesaler, and these deals have been pretty substantial. We're talking, you know, six and seven figures, depending on the territory that's being sold. So there's some adverse consequences to that. Obviously, a wholesaler that purchases a brewery's rights wants to get to see a return on that investment. So they're, of course, giving preference to those brands that they paid something for. And I've had a few clients that have negotiated a way out of their distribution agreement with their wholesaler and taken back their brand to self-distribute because they weren't one that had paid something. They had signed up with this distributor before the advent of this sale of rights came about, and they decided that we're not getting the love, so we're not getting the right shelf space, we're not getting enough tap lines, we can do this better ourselves. And the wholesalers have been willing to let them out. So, which leads me to the next point, which is the 12 states that have created what they call a small brewer exemption to the state distribution law. Like I mentioned before, this whole system came about because of a concern about when the breweries were consolidating 40, 50 years ago, that they had the ability to push wholesalers to do, you know, like regulate the prices, discriminate between wholesalers, you know, make them take, you know, product they didn't want. And so this is why this system came about. The argument has been as of late that the actually right now it's really the opposite's happening. you have all these small breweries, that's where the growth is in the beer market, and these wholesalers are consolidating. So the discussion has been, does the same system apply? Should we have greater freedoms for these smaller breweries that may not affect as much of the wholesaler's portfolio as a big brewery? Because what generally happens practically is if a brewery wants to get out of its distribution agreement and go with another distributor, the distributors talk and work out the price for that, but one distributor is going to pay for the rights from the other one, and the brewery's kind of cut out of it. And the brewery's kind of say, we don't want that. We want to be able to take back our brand and shop it to somebody else. So what's come about has been this, what they call a small brewer exemption, and I've got them listed in the materials, the states that have one so far. So, for example, Arkansas. The hallmark of this is you're defining what a small brewery is, and then the way of getting out of it, with or without cause, it's a matter of you pay a far smaller price to get out of your, you may just be buying back your unwanted inventory. So, for Arkansas, it's a small brewery is 45,000 barrels or less. We've got Colorado, less than 300,000 gallons. Illinois has been one that a lot of folks that are proposing these statutes in other states has been looking at. Illinois, based on the percentage that brewer's products represented in the wholesaler's portfolio. So Illinois says small brewer assembly's annual volume of products supplied represents 10% or less of the wholesaler's entire business. Nevada. Less than 2,000 barrels of malt beverages in any calendar year. New York, less than 300,000 barrels. North Carolina, fewer than 25,000 barrels. So all of these different states have defined what a small brewer is. Then you get into what they have to pay. Some of them are, it could be, still there's reasonable compensation. Some of them still do refer to arbitration. Some just say, you can terminate by, and just basically pay for your unsold inventory. So wholesalers really don't like these statutes because, again, the distribution laws are something of a deterrent to keep brewers from trying to terminate their agreement. So to make it easier, they don't like that. So I do think, though, that time will tell, but I do think that this is the trend. I think that I think that folks are looking at they really do have kind of a bifurcated system, that the rules that apply to the relationship between AB InBev, which is now the parent company of Budweiser, and the wholesaler is different than the relationship between a small craft brewer that maybe does 2,500 barrels a year and a distributor. So I do think that there are breweries out there, and I have some other clients of mine, that have deliberately set up business models that don't rely on the three-tier system. They don't rely on third-party distribution. It's simply you can come to their tap room and consume it on sale or on premise, or you can purchase it from there and take it home for off-sale consumption. I think that we would see some of these breweries might come off the sidelines and want to do some distribution if they were able to have an exemption like this or exception to the distribution law. I do believe that it's a deterrent to others kind of expanding. So we'll see, though, how many states do enact these because, like I said, the wholesalers are vehemently opposed to them. So with the little bit of time we have left here, I want to talk a little bit about the distribution issues in the wine and spirits industries. I talk a lot here about the beer distribution laws because they were codified. For the most part, the general rule for, at least here in Minnesota, we have kind of three different buckets for the wine and spirits. For wine, it depends on where it's made. We have a farm winery statute because, of course, Minnesota being a heavy agricultural state, that gives kind of most favored status under our liquor laws in terms of manufacturers to farm wineries. So if you're located on agricultural land and making wine products, and that could include cider and mead as well, you can pretty much do anything. I mean, you can self-distribute, you can do all that stuff. If you're a non-farm winery, you can do, you know, on-site tastings. You can sell product, you know, there for on-premise consumption. You can sell product on-site for off-premise consumption. And, but you can't self-distribute. You have to sign up with a distributor. That's the same on our distilling side, for distilleries. They have to sign up with a distributor. There is no self-distribution rights. The only thing they can do, they can do a cocktail room, and they can sell 375-milliliter bottle per customer per day, as long as the product is also made available to wholesalers. So, the difference between this and the breweries, though, is these contracts can be terminated. They don't have these franchise termination laws that breweries do. So we usually might see these on like a 3 to 5 year term, and they have some provisions in there for how it would be terminated for cause, but also what happens when the agreement is terminated overall. Usually we'll say something like, you know, any products that have been supplied to the wholesaler, you know, the manufacturer, the winery, or the distillery, buy them back, you know, take their unused inventory back and pay them for it. So, basically give them a big refund. As of late, and at least here in Minnesota, we have one distributor that probably has 95% of all of the spirits distribution in the state. And so they've been pretty easy to deal with, but there's a second larger national distributor also coming to town and trying to compete with them. So all of a sudden my negotiations have changed with each of these, with the distributors. I've got about a half dozen of these distribution deals for distilleries. And I did one, the other changes. The second one came down. They sent me the same document that they sent me the first time, with the first before I revised it. So the way I handled it was I revised it, gave it back to my client, I told them, tell them who your attorney is, meaning let them know that you know that they're willing to make all these changes. So they made the changes. The same thing with the third guy and the fourth guy. I get to number five and six right now. And all of a sudden, they're pushing back on wanting 2x gross margin for non-renewal of the contract. And the reason being that now they have a competitor coming into town. So they have so they may not have a monopoly anymore, so now they're trying to, you know, protect their portfolio. So I don't know what it is in that business, in that wholesale side, that they just, the territorialism and protectionism just comes out. So when they have good lawyers, you have to negotiate with. So, So it's a little bit different for those systems. It's a lot more heavily on the contract side, because you don't have the franchise laws. I haven't seen a sale of rights yet for either a distillery or a winery, but I don't necessarily know that you couldn't, just because you don't have the right to self-distribute. You could still shop if you think it's more of a product of there aren't enough. There isn't enough competition amongst wholesalers to be able to shop the brands versus this whether or not somebody could self-distribute. So, anyway, I think that's everything that I have. So, as you can see, this is a pretty interesting area. It's a complicated area. As practitioners, you need to if you're going to draft these documents, you need to be aware of the, you know, the implications for them. I know it's either any contract, but there's some this is essentially a lifetime arrangement, and you have to be careful with it. And if you can get a sale of rights, that's great. If you can't, then you have to just figure out. Sometimes I get clients that start out with me, and they may not be right for a sale yet. So we got to be, then we look at, okay, self-distribution. How long do we want to self-distribute? If we're dealing with a distillery or a winery, then we want to look at, okay, well, how short of a contract can we get so we can get a buzz going before we could start shopping our rights. So a lot of issues involved with this. It's a complex area. It's a fun area. Sometimes it's frustrating, but it's also fun to work on these. But it's an important piece, and as you can see, there's a lot of history built up in this piece of liquor law. So I put my contact info in the last slide here. If there's anybody, feel free to always contact me with questions. I'm always happy to answer questions from folks. And I appreciate you taking the time to listen to this, and I hope you learned something. So thank you.